You're listening to the Euro 96 Throwback Series on the Scottish Football Forums podcast, the home of Scottish football banter.
From Glasgow to Berlin, we're here to see the Scotland, and now we're scoring the goals, and we score one or two, McGann will score a few, and then we'll beg you some more. We're going to Germany.
Hello and welcome to the Euro 96 Throwback Series on SFF Podcast, a four-part special looking back at the Euro 96 finals through the eyes of journalists and podcasters from eight of the 16 nations involved in the tournament. I'm John Bleasdale, and not only am I hosting this series, but I have co-written a book with Neil Doherty called We're Going to Wembley, Scotland's Euro 96 Journey from Pitch Publishing. The book details Scotland's route to the finals through the voices of former players, journalists, the Tartan Army, and the late Craig Brown, and is officially released on 27th of May 2024. In the meantime, sit back and enjoy this episode of the Euro 96 Throwback Series on SFF Podcast. In this section of our Euro 96 Throwback Series, we look at the fortunes of Portugal, and I'm delighted to be joined by creator and editor of Portugal website and Portugal correspondent for World Soccer magazine, Tom Kunderts. Tom, thanks for coming on SFF Podcast. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. No problem, John. Always happy to speak about Portugal, especially when, you know, we're coming up to a big tournament. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, just for our audience, this is not a Portuguese accent, and Tom is not a Portuguese name, so you're going to have to explain to those who are listening, because you moved to Lisbon 1984, I understand. What was the reason, and where did the interest in Portuguese football begin for you?
Yeah, well, I've got Portuguese roots. My mother is Portuguese, so I'm actually half Portuguese. But I was born and raised in England, and I've always been, you know, a fanatical football fan, West Bromwich Albion fan for my sins back in the UK. But when I came to Portugal, to be perfectly honest, I didn't know an awful lot about Portuguese football. But what I found was a country absolutely obsessed with the game, and just this incredible amount of talent and history and rivalry, and it's just a paradise, John. If you love football, Portugal is a paradise of a country to live in. And so I kind of slowly immersed myself into Portuguese football. And of course, I was quite fortunate that it coincided with the emergence of one of the two best players in the world, who happened to be Portuguese, and probably the most, you know, high-profile player from the media point of view, maybe the game has ever seen, and possibly the most high-profile coach also the game has ever seen. And of course, the Portuguese national team has just been on the up and up over the last two decades. So all of that came together quite nicely.
Yeah, so basically, what you're saying is you're going to take the credit for the rise in Portuguese football since 1994.
yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all down to me.
in all seriousness, before you went over, Portugal did go a couple of major terms without reaching, because they'd got to the 86 World Cup, but then they failed to qualify for Euros 88 and 92, and then World Cups 1994. But in the latter tournaments for 92 and 94, they weren't far away. You know, I remember, unfortunately, they beat Scotland 5-0 in USA 94 qualifying, but, you know, there were signs there that although they still missed out to Italy and Switzerland, there were signs that they were about to emerge into a pretty good team in years to come.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's probably all based on, of course, the famous Portuguese golden generation, which was the young players, the generation of Rui Costa, Luís Figo, Fernando Couto, those players which actually won Portugal the World Youth Cup in 1989. And then that was in Saudi Arabia. And then they repeated it. They actually won back-to-back youth cups. They won in 1991 here in Portugal, the final in Lisbon against Brazil. So, you know, the foundations were there. The youth setup was there. That was Carlos Queiroz, who gets a lot of credit for organising the Portuguese Federation, because Portugal have always had great talent, but they've always had, until the late 90s, terrible organisation, just a whole level of chaos in the Football Federation, which kind of held them back. But that started to be sorted out finally in the 90s. And in terms of youth football, again, Carlos Queiroz, whatever people think of him in, his various roles as managers all over the decades, he's hugely respected in Portugal as probably the most important person to really put that structure in place to enable Portugal to start producing these world-class talents, almost like off a conveyor belt. And so, yeah, you're right. The 90s was the kind of the start, we could say, the start of something good was brewing.
Yeah, and it was starting to come to fruition during this qualifying campaign, and in a group that contained a Northern a Republic of Ireland side who had been doing very well. I mean, Portugal win seven, draw two, and just lose once to the Irish, which was courtesy of an own goal. They win the group by 6 points. Rui Costa scores a cracker against Ireland in the final game to win it 3-0. It was almost plain sailing in terms of that group, and also a good win away to Northern Ireland and at home to Austria as well, which I think all those three results proved pivotal in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just mentioned it, a while ago that Portugal were not used to qualifying for tournaments. Sometimes people kind of forget that Portugal, because they've had so much success over the last 20 years, but at that time, you could almost consider Portugal a minnow in terms of European teams, certainly in terms of the World Cup. But one stat I always like to bring up is in the 20th century, there were 22 World Cups and European Championships, and Portugal only qualified for four of them. It was very unusual for them. They were only at two World Cups, excuse me, before this 1996 Euro. And they'd only been to one Euro before this one in 1984. So, it was the usual was for Portugal to not even qualify. So that completely changed, of course. And since the 21st century, since the year 2000, they haven't missed one tournament. They've gone to all 12 they've been since then, and they've gone quite deep in a lot of tournaments. So going back to 1996, you have to kind of remember that. It was very unusual for Portugal to qualify with such ease. And there were, I remember, huge celebrations. I remember that last game against Ireland here in Lisbon. It was absolutely teaming it down. It was more like a day that you'd expect in Dublin rather than Lisbon. It was just a torrential storm, basically. And yeah, you're right, that Rui Costa chip from about 30 yards was absolutely amazing to get the ball rolling. And there were huge celebrations at the end of that because, like I say, it was not usual. Portugal had missed out on the previous two tournaments and they'd only been to, three others prior to that. So, yeah, people were really looking forward to it.
Yeah, they definitely would have been. And just looking at the squad that you took to England for that tournament, there was only five non-Portuguese based players in that squad. So you had Paulo Sousa, who'd won the Champions League, Luis Figo, obviously, Barcelona, Rui Costa, Fiorentina, Fernando Couto, and Parma, and a name that Scottish football fans will be familiar with, Georges Cadec, because he'd just joined Celtic what earlier that year as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that went well, didn't it? Yeah, that's brought up quite often here in Portuguese football circles because he was, that was really the highlight of his career, without doubt. They created that song just for Georges Cadec, which is quite unusual for in Portugal. We haven't really got that fan culture of creating specific songs for specific players. So that went well. But yeah, you're right. That's just another illustration. Five players. Out of, I'm not sure if it was a 23-man squad or 21-man squad at that
It's
time, but
22.
22. Okay, so you have just five players. The vast majority of players, home-based players, and if you go to previous tournaments, it would be, maybe just one or two, maybe not even zero. All the players would have come from Benfica or Porto or Sporting, one or two of the, kind of mid-table Portuguese clubs. Would have provided the bulk of that squad. And that's another illustration of how things have changed in, I'm glad you brought it up, John, because I was actually going to talk about this in the 2022 World Cup. There were, so it's a 26-man squad because of COVID. Remember, we had the extended squad, and there were actually only seven home-based players, seven domestic players, but it's all the others, 19 foreign-based players. So that kind of shows you that it's almost gone 360 degrees. You know, this was it's a good illustration of how that was really the start of something big. You know, I think 1996.
Yeah, I think to be fair, when you look at most squads, it's almost similar because the three-corner rule was still in place at that point. I think that was the last year of the three-corner rule, but obviously whether it's changed for better, that's another debate for another podcast. But in terms of the tournament itself, I mean, it was also the first tournament to qualify for 10 years. They were drawn in the group with defending European champions Denmark, debutants Turkey, or was that their first one? I can't remember. And settlers debutants Croatia. What was the expectation for Portugal? Was it just simply win this group and go as far as possible?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it was quite, it was, you know, it was difficult to know what to expect. Yeah, because you're absolutely right. They were both debutants, actually, you know, Turkey and Croatia. And, you know, and like I say, Portugal wasn't, you know, a kind of regular. Of course, the Euros were much smaller, weren't they? So there wasn't that many teams in them anyway, but only really the big teams that would have gone there, you know, almost every year, so every tournament. So, yeah, you know, I think Portugal were just really pleased to go there. Obviously, you know, Rui Costa was emerging, Luís Figo were emerging. They were already having success abroad. You know, people knew that these were special players, special talents. And so there was a level of expectation, but nothing like what it is today. You know, I think it was almost people going along for the ride, hoping for the best, but, you know, not necessarily expecting to go particularly far.
Yeah, I think there might have been a dark horse element, but I think the favourites certainly would have been Germany. Maybe Italy were considered at that point, although they didn't have a good tournament, which we'll talk a little later. But at Portugal, I think we're certainly at worst expecting to get to quarterfinals. But a draw in the opening game against Denmark. They came from behind as Brian Laudrup scored to open the score, and then Sapinto with a nice little header, actually, from a bounce cross. Judged that very well, but viewed as a good point, given you were one down.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember the manager afterwards was really happy about that because that was considered our toughest game. So, you know, if we could get anything from that game, it would really set us up for, you know, a very good chance for qualifying from the group. And so, yeah, and like I said, having to come from behind, you know, made it even better. Of course, Denmark, they were the reigning champions. They ended up having a very poor tournament. I think they went out in the group stage. I'm not quite sure. Yeah, they would have gone out in the group stage, shouldn't they? But, you know, that, going into the tournament, I think they would have been the favourites to win that group just because they were the champions and they were more experienced at tournament football than the other three nations. So, yeah, no doubt about it. He was, you know, that was considered a, you know, a good solid start for Portugal.
Yeah, it definitely was. The next game was, I think, Portugal expected to be quite comfortable against the Turks because Turkey weren't quite at the level they went to a couple of years later in the future World Cup, for example. But it was a bit of a slog, that game. I think it epitomised some games in the tournament, to be honest. There wasn't a lot of quality football. It was very few in goal-mouth action. And the goal eventually came in 66 minutes through an unlikely source in terms of a left-footed volley by Fernando Couto, but it was quite well taken.
Yeah, he had that in his locker. You know, he's one of the five players you mentioned before who was one of Portugal's stars because he played abroad. And he was quite free scoring for a centre-back, you know, for Portugal. He scored a few goals, of course, most of them with his head. So, yeah, you're right. It wasn't very usual to see him banging in volleys. And I agree with you exactly. This game, you know, Portugal had played some really nice football in the first game against Denmark. And this game, you know, didn't quite show it. They earned really a reputation, I think, in this tournament for that. There was a famous phrase by Ruud Gullit who said that Portugal plays sexy football. And that was, you know, they just play. I suppose you have to really when you've got players like Rui Costa and Figo and João Vieira Pinto, even Folia, the winger, Domingos Paciência. You know, these are all really technically gifted players who, you know, can really play some really nice, neat, skillful, flair football. And so, but in this particular game against Turkey, yeah, they didn't really get going. And I think it was probably the importance of the game because Turkey had lost their first game, of course. So for them, it was do or die. I'm not sure if they'd lost or drawn, but they needed points, especially Portugal. Again, they knew if they'd won this game, virtually sealed the deal. They were virtually through. So, the second game you often see in tournaments, the second game is there's so much riding on it that sometimes you don't see the best football, and I think that's what happened here.
Yeah, I mean that result did put Turkey out because they lost the first game to Croatia, and Croatia ended up automatically qualifying by beating Denmark. So Portugal hadn't quite sealed the deal yet, but all they had to do was match or better Denmark's result in the final game. And I think I was speaking to Tomislav Gabalic from Croatia about this one, and I think Croatia almost took their eye off the ball because they made eight changes. How much did that play into Portugal's hands? But also just to counter that, how good a performance was this from Portugal, who knew they had to do the job, and they did a very good job in the end by winning 3-0?
Absolutely. It was strange. I remember that's always been a bit of curiosity. I'd be very interested to listen back to your conversation with your Croatian correspondent, because it seemed a very, how can we say, very, I suppose, bold move by the coach, virtually changing the whole team, which, and they ended up risking, and of course it happened, finishing second, because I think at that stage it was already known. It's virtually certain that whoever would finish second would face Germany, who of course were the favourites, and they ended up winning it, didn't they? So it did seem a strange decision. But Portugal obviously had no bearing on that. They just took full advantage. Maybe Croatia underestimated them a bit. I think this was a game where really Portugal did show that, all that flair, all that creativity, played some really nice football, and really just, it swept Croatia away. If it had been the full Croatia team, I'm sure it would have been a different story. But that Portugal team were just too good. Also, an interesting point to bear in mind, which I think had consequences for the quarterfinal against the Czech Republic, is that Portugal played virtually the same team all three group games, and so there wasn't really any rotation. They had a settled 11. Or I suppose that's putting it kindly, they had 11 players who were clearly better than the backups, and so they ended up using all of those. So by the time the third game came around, they were really at the top of the game, playing well, good dynamics in the team, good cohesion. Everyone knew exactly where they should be, but perhaps they paid for that a little bit in the quarters.
Yeah, but I mean that's probably a fair comment because Portugal were quite lethargic in that quarter final, and on paper you looked at thinking, Czech Republic, this is one that Portugal should get through, but I don't think people under I think some people underestimated how good a team this Czech Republic team actually were. I mean they would also go on and go on to reach the final, of course, and then were close to winning Euro 2004 as well. But they came unstuck, and it was a. I mean, to be fair, it's a great goal by Pavoska, it wins it, but it was a bit of a damp squib from Portugal that day.
I think so. I think that's fair enough. Of course, Paul Bosky is interesting. He would later come to Portugal to play for Benfica, and so a very well-known player here in Portugal for both those reasons. Of course, being ex-Benfica and being the man who scored that, one of the most audacious goals in tournament football, you could hope. You have to remember Vitor Bahia, really top goalkeeper. That's another one of these kind of golden generation players who doesn't get as much, kind of praise or publicity as obviously names like Luis Figo and so on. But he's also really top quality player. Ended up playing for Barcelona, won trophies galore at Porto. Prior, I think only one or two Portuguese keepers have got more caps than him. So yeah, it's good keep. It was good goalkeeper. But that goal, being lobbed from, I'm not sure if it was inside the area, but it was quite close to goal. And he was quite what made it so unusual, I suppose, is that Paul Bosca was quite close to Bahia. And it went so high in the air, it was quite an unusual lob. But unfortunately, got shown time and time again. As far as the reaction goes in Portugal, of course, huge disappointment. People were getting really excited. They thought, this could be something special. I mentioned to you earlier, John, that Portugal had only been to three tournaments ever before this tournament. But the thing is, when they got there, they usually made a bit of a splash. Of course, the first one was 1966, their first World Cup. They got to the semi-final before being beaten by England. Next one was 1984 Euros, and they played in France, where again, they got to the semi-finals before losing to the hosts, curiously enough. You know, France, in one of the best games in football history, that 3-2 in Marseille. And then, so that was that the only one? Yeah, and then they went to, and the 86, of course. Yeah, Mexico 86. And yeah, that one was a bit of a disaster. So, but, you know, the two out of the three previous tournaments they'd been to, they'd really done well. So people were thinking, you know, and they were close, weren't they? If you think about it, just one win away to making the semis again. But yeah, you know, unfortunately, it was ended by that moment of magic by Paul Bosky.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, I mean, this was a Portugal team making their first appearance at major tournament for 10 years. It was a golden generation. It'd been youth team winners from a few years before. But how much did they learn going into future campaigns? Because although they didn't qualify for the World Cup, the next year is the year 2000. They were absolutely fantastic and very unlucky not to reach that final. I mean, to be fair, any one of those four semi-finalists in Euro 2000, which personally is my favourite Euros, could all have made a good case for saying they deserved to win, because there were four top sides in that semi-final.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, again, that semi-final was, you know, like you say, could have gone either way. Another great match. Zinedine Zidane just absolutely unbelievable in that semi. But yeah, you know, there's no doubt about it. You know, it helped. I suppose it was all about building maturity, building confidence, and definitely Portugal getting to more tournaments, getting to this tournament and not looking out of place. Definitely would have had, a big impact and given players more confidence. I think perhaps, to be completely honest, I think what made as much difference, possibly even more difference, was the fact that Portugal had more and more players at this stage, starting having more and more players going abroad and going to the top clubs. I remember interviewing Rui Costa years ago. I think it was before one of the World Cups, maybe in 2014 or something. And he was talking about this era in Portuguese football when he himself, and Luís Figo, and Fernando Couto, and then there was a few which went to Barcelona afterwards, started going to other clubs. It really made a difference to these big foreign clubs, because you kind of lost that inferiority complex. First of all, the players themselves, they were playing alongside the best players in the world, training against them, training alongside them day after day. So that automatically improves you as a player. But also, perhaps more importantly, not feeling that you're inferior to them. You know, you're saying, oh, you know, I belong in this company. So yeah, it was, there's no doubt about it. It was important in the, you know, the kind of evolution and the upward trajectory which Portuguese football was going through at the time. It was an important step. But I'd say it was, you know, perhaps alongside the fact that more and more players were going to big foreign clubs, I think that was an equally important factor.
Yeah, ironically, looking ahead to Euro 2024, two of the sides that Portugal played in Euro 96 are in their group, Turkey and, yeah. Well, it's now Czechia, in the group F, and then it's the winners of Playoff C, which has got Georgia, Luxembourg, trying to remember the other side. I think it's
Kazakhstan, is it?
Yeah, Greece and Kazakhstan, that's the one. I knew Greece was the one in the semi. So, you know, what's the expectations for Portugal? Obviously, that's the Portugal side that won all 10 qualifiers, although I'm going to be honest, I don't think he's won the hardest group, but you still did well and win 10 out of 10. What chance do you give Portugal of going far in this competition? Personally, I think they're one of two who can threaten France and England, who are the favourites, the other being Spain.
Yeah, you know, people in Portugal, pretty confident, like you said, you know, the amazing qualifying campaign with that big asterisk next to it, you know, when you look at the opponents. And people were a little bit disappointed at all the pre-match friendlies, which are coming up. We're playing, Portugal are going to play Sweden and Slovenia now in March. And then I can't quite remember exactly the opponents, but I think the only really... you could say top class, and even that's not really one of the top class side we're playing in, you know, those friendlies in June just before the tournament is Croatia, actually, funnily enough. And so that, you know, it's very difficult to know exactly how good this Portugal side is. They've swept all before then, they've scored goals galore. It's the first time they've gone through a qualifying campaign, winning 10 out of 10. It's the most goals they've ever scored in a qualifying campaign. That's the most goals any team scored in this qualifying campaign by quite a long way. And so, you know, there's always been a feeling in Portugal that they should play more attacking football, and that Fernando Santos, who was there for a long time, of course, had, you know, won Euro 2016 in the way Portugal did. Some people think it actually kind of held Portugal back, because that was their model. Basically, he was a very conservative manager, very defence-minded manager. And Portugal, as we've been discussing in 1996 and really all throughout history, have been a team which has produced real flair players and players who thrive playing an attacking game. And to be fair, Roberto Martinez has done a fantastic job so far. It was a very surprise, took everyone by surprise when he was appointed. I have to admit, it wasn't an appointment which was particularly popular at the time, but everything he's done so far, you know, excellent, 5 stars, and including little things which are important, like he is Spanish, of course, so it's easier for him, but he made an effort to learn Portuguese. He speaks perfectly, more or less perfect Portuguese, and that's, you know, scored him a lot of points with the local journalism, just with the people and the fans in general, because that may seem like a small point, but here in Portugal, for instance, there's lots of Spanish players, lots of South American players who never speak anything but Spanish. You know, even if they're in Portugal for 5 or 10 years, they just always speak French, because of course Portuguese people can understand them. But it, you know, I think just to add a kind of layer of respect to their player, and also to communicate, you know, well with the media and with the fans, and also with the players, you know, his Portuguese is excellent. And so, yeah, he's you know, it's all quite exciting.
Yeah, it definitely is. It'll be interesting to see how far that Portugal can go. Can they replicate 2016? Well, only time will tell. And finally, Tom, I'm asking this of everyone of my guests. So, name a combined Euro 96 and current Portugal 11, and it doesn't matter about weighting it what way. It can go
I
5-6 or 8-3, whatever one you
remember.
want.
Oh, I'm sorry, John. I remember I just got in a bit late and I remembered you asked me this. So I'm going to have to do this a bit off the cuff because I wanted to prepare it. I didn't manage to prepare it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you which players from 96 would definitely get in the current squad. And of course, very obvious ones: Luís Figo, Rui Costa. It's funny though, because Portugal's, you know, possibly their strongest position now is their midfield, of course, Bernardo Silva and Bruno Fernandes. So I'm just going to pick a completely offensive team. So they would be my four midfielders. Maybe as the defensive midfielder, I'd also choose, yeah, let's go for one strike up front. So I'd go for João Palhinha, who I think is an absolutely superb player. I think he's going to be a shoo-in for the 11. And then, okay, up front, even though he's aging, even though he's past his best, it's got to be Cristiano Ronaldo,
You had
no
to,
doubts
yeah.
about that. Yeah. and then, okay, at the back, the keeper, I think I'll go for Vitor Bahia, yeah, the 96 goalkeeper. Okay, back four, you'd have to go for, yeah, you'd have to go for João Cancelo, I think, without doubt. Left back, okay, this depends a lot, injury permitting, because the PSG left back, Nuno Mendes, is an absolutely world-class player. He's definitely one of the best left backs in the world, but he's had terrible injury problems over the last couple of seasons. He's only returned quite recently to PSG, so it's not 100% sure he's going to be in the squad, but if he is, hopefully, he's been playing the last few weeks, he would be my left back. And then the centre backs, so let me see, in 86 it was Fernando Couto, Helder, Cristóvão Agüero, Ruben Dias, Pep. Yeah, I think I'd go for Fernando Couto and Ruben Dias.
Yes.
So.
That's a very good team, and I like how you started with your front line and then put the defence in and put around it. Although I think Scottish fans will be disappointed you haven't put, or Celtic fans will be disappointed you've not put George Cadet in there, but he also tamed Scotland in 93, so it's maybe good you didn't put him in, but he didn't play much in your 96, to be fair. Well, listen, Tom, thank you very much for your time, giving your memories of Euro 96, and enjoy Euro 2024.
Okay, no problem. Same to you, John. Look forward to listening to the other episodes.
In this section of our Year 96 throwback series, we look at the fortunes of the Netherlands, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dutch football expert and news editor at flashscore.com, Finlay Krabolda. Finlay, welcome to Scottish Football Forum's podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Some people might be listening thinking that's not a Dutch accent. Can you just explain a little bit about yourself, please?
So I'm from a Dutch family, but just as I was born, moved over to England. So I've grown up in England, but... yeah, they made sure that I grew up supporting the Netherlands, otherwise I would have been disowned.
Well, that's certainly a good thing. But you're obviously quite young, as we discussed off air, but you did do your research for this about Euro 96. How old were you at the time when Euro 96 happened?
So I was actually born just after Euro 96.
All right, okay. So, yeah, you definitely had a lot of research, but thank you very much for coming on. So from what you've been told as part of your research, Netherlands obviously changed from Dick Advocaat to Gus Hiddink. This tends to happen a lot with the Dutch. They tend to recycle managers, don't they? But how was, from what you're aware of, how was this received, especially given the fact Netherlands did relatively well in the USA? They reached the quarterfinals, were unlucky against Brazil.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mixed bag in America, because I mean, kind of went out in style to Brazil in a pretty good performance, but before that, things hadn't been great. It wasn't that exciting football which the Dutch fans always want, and no one had really wanted Dick Advocaat in the first place because everybody wanted Johan Cruyff as the manager, but the KNVB thought that he was too expensive and too controlling, so they brought Dick Advocaat in. So he was never really that popular. Gus Hiddink had done really well at PSV before, so generally it was a positive appointment. I think it was generally quite well received in the country.
Yeah, he would go on to do well eventually, but it was a bit of a tricky qualifying section. You know, they were in a very tough section with Czech Republic and Norway predominantly, and at one point it wasn't looking good because the Czechs beat them 3-1 in April 95, and then in June 95, probably more surprisingly, lost 1-0 to Belarus, and it needed a great last match day performance against Norway to spare their blushes, which put them in the playoff with Ireland, and obviously they came through that thanks to the Patrick Kluivert double. You know, was it as much a relief more than joy at qualification?
Yeah, I think so. It was relief more than anything. And I think it was kind of a case of, you know, if we hadn't qualified, people would have thought, well, we don't deserve to be there. It wouldn't have been like, you know, an injustice or unlucky. It was, you know, dropped points against Belarus, against Czech Republic, against Norway. I mean, pretty disastrous qualifying on the whole. And yeah, in the end, I mean, Hiddink was never too keen on using young players. So he finally gave Patrick Kluivert a chance in the playoffs, more of a chance, and that kind of paid off. So that injected a bit more optimism heading into the final tournament.
Yeah, I mean, we've always talked about Kluivert, but obviously in 95 was the year Ajax won the Champions League, and then they reached the final the following year, of course, and they had Van der Sar and goal. You had the De Boer twins, you had Overmars, you had Seedorf, you had Davids, you know, a real array of talent. You know, how much enthusiasm did they inject into that squad? Because, you know, although it was a decent squad, it looked as though it needed that little bit of injection of youth in it.
Yeah, for sure. I think, obviously, yeah, that Ajax team had won the Champions League the year before. And it was a really exciting team on the whole, full of young players. Like you said, it had David, Seedorf, the De Boer twins, Kluivert. But it was kind of a curse and a blessing, because while it was a great team, it was also, there'd been a lot of conflict at Ajax because the older players, Danny Blind, the De Boer twins, were on much higher salaries than the younger, more exciting talents like Kluivert, Seedorf, and Davids. So they were pretty unhappy about that heading into the European Championships. The younger players, Kluivert, David, Seedorf, and that definitely kind of carried over into the tournament and had a pretty damaging effect on morale.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come on to David shortly, but before we do, I mean, Neil's also drawn in our group, and England and Switzerland as well. And what was the expectation for the Dutch going into the tournament? They must have been viewed as one of the front runners for the tournament, along the likes of Germany and possibly France and England.
Yeah, I think so. I think if you look only at the squad quality, I think the expectations were really semi-finals at the least. The same as the European Championships before that, 92. Semi-finals at the least. Obviously, back then it was a smaller tournament. So really, anything less than a semi-final would be viewed as a not a disaster, because it's not an easy group. Obviously, being drawn with England. If you finish second, you get a tough quarter final. But generally, it was, the expectation was semis, and there was kind, that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, I remember ahead of the Scotland game. I think there was a couple of players that said that they hadn't heard of any of the Scotland players at all and things like that. You know, typical arrogance and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt Scotland rode their luck a little bit. Andy Gorham makes a great save early on, and there's the John Collins handball on the line. But that aside, I think Scotland put in a gritty performance, and the Dutch were frustrated against the Scotland side with backs to the wall and had a couple of little chances ourselves. A draw, arguably a fair result, but even if we take bias out of the equation, how was that received back home in the Netherlands?
Yeah, not good really. Like you said, there was a lot of arrogance before the match. I think in terms of, just expecting a kind of comfortable win with just because of the talent we had. And you look back, you think if we did start with a win, then the whole tournament might have been a bit different, because you've got a happier camp. You don't have the conflicts that kind of stem from the draw to Scotland, then hitting kind of overreacts a bit and changes it makes some big changes for the Switzerland match.
Yeah, what I need to ask, what is it about the Dutch that sometimes when they, I mean, they've been blessed, from mighty. I remember that Dutch team at Euro 92 with the likes of Van Basten and Rijkaard, etc. They were a top side. They've always been blessed with top players, but arguably they've underachieved at certain major tournaments with the talent they've had. Why do you think there's almost an implosion at some point within the camp at major tournaments?
Yeah, I think a short answer would be we're rubbish at taking penalties, because
That's true.
this was a run where we went 92, 94, 96, 98, 2000 went out on penalties. Pretty incredible. No, not 94 actually, but not yeah the others. And yeah, there's also this, I don't know, I think you don't want to lump a whole nation into one kind of character trait, but Dutch people can be quite confident, to put it kindly, arrogant, to put it less kindly. And there's always egos in the camps, always big characters, and a lot of times that caused problems. I mean, really, this was one of the first tournaments where it really did cause a big problem. There's kind of this, reputation in the UK, definitely, that the Dutch always kind of destroy themselves. And I think that's largely because of what happened at Euro 96.
Yeah, and in the second game, they do go and beat Switzerland. Now, you mentioned Johan Cruyff. His son, Jordi, scores a pretty good goal to make it 1-0. Got a move to Manchester United from Barcelona in the back of it. That didn't go well as we all know. Dennis Bergkamp scores the second, and you think, well, things are playing safe, 1 foot in the next round. But then afterwards, Edgar Davids is sent home for criticising the manager. You know, talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, it was a weird one, because it was a good win on paper, 2-0 against Switzerland. But you had Edgar Davids was dropped, which he wasn't very happy about. And then, to make matters worse, his Ajax pal Clarence Seedorf, similar generation, they came through together. He was played in a more defensive position, didn't play well, and got substituted off pretty early. And if you go back and look at some highlights, you can see the camera kind of cut to the two of them on the bench complaining about Hiddink with each other, basically. And then, yeah, David comes out and says that Hiddink needs to get his head out of some players' bums, to put it politely. And that's it, obviously. I think Hiddink's hands are kind of tied at that point. You can't really... I think, you know, you had Davids complaining to a lot of other players, trying to get a lot of other Ajax players on board too. So I think Hiddink did have to send him home, but also Hiddink didn't deal with any of the young players very well in that tournament, I don't think. I think, you know, they thought they were great. He should have given them that confidence, kind of massaged their egos a bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously they've prepared and years come by, but yeah, You go into England game with all this hanging over your head. But that said, the permutations were still very much in the Dutch favour. You know, they just had to make sure that they avoided defeat and they were through to the next round. Scotland needed to win by a 3 or 4 goal swing, a 3-0 win, a 1-0 defeat to the Dutch. And looking at the Dutch team on paper, I've got the team line up now for when you're playing England. So even without Davids, you've still got Van der Sar, Reiziger, Blind, Seedorf, Ronald de Boer, Bergkamp, Hoekstra, Winter, Witschka, Bogarden, Cruyff. It's a decent team. How on earth did they end up going 4 down? And it was an uncomfortable situation for Scotland fans almost, because we ended up cheering England scoring the fourth goal, which put us in the brink to the next round.
Yeah. I mean, as a Netherlands fan growing up in England, I've heard about that match far too many times over the years, seen way too many clips of all those goals. I mean, yeah, like you said, there was a lot of talent. And again, I know, speaking like for my family especially, they at that point in time, they in the Netherlands, a lot of people didn't really take even England that seriously, because England hadn't really done much at major tournaments since 66. You know, they'd had a strong Italia 90, but so again, generally, it was sort of, you know, David has gone home now. We've got the big problem away. So, and yeah, just a disaster. I mean, the players weren't happy with each other. There was no kind of coordination. And it was obviously an England team that was pretty vibrant, you know, playing the sort of attacking football that everybody had wanted from the Netherlands. But we just didn't have the kind of cohesiveness to get anywhere near that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just extraordinary. I mean, England, it was one of the best England performances of all time. You know, I spoke to Henry Winter, and he can concur that was within the top five for in his lifetime watching England. And they were just exceptional. And it's looking as if Scotland are going through, because ironically, it's 4-0 England and 1-0 Scotland. That's going to be enough. But of course, in this true Scottish story, that's not going to just play out. And Patrick Kluivert sticks one through Seaman's legs. I mean, we joke in Scotland that Seaman let that in to get Scotland put out. But let's be honest, England had already went above the call of duty by winning 4-1, and Scotland just didn't do enough. But how much of a relief was that when Kluivert stuck that in, and, you know, just to get through but by the skin of their teeth?
Yeah, I've spoken to people that remember it, and I mean, just a surreal feeling, you know, celebrating making like losing 4-1 because you're still going through. It's just bizarre. And Patrick Kluivert, again, had sort of, he did it in the playoffs as well. He scored the big goals, but it's in a situation that they shouldn't be in the first place. You know, it's like, it's an odd symmetry there. And yeah, I mean, there wasn't really much celebration going on. Finished second in the group and you have France next up. It was kind of like, well, that's just going to be even worse.
Yeah, they must have feared a defeat in the next round, but it turned out to be a pretty awful game of football. I mean, there weren't many great knockout games at Euro 96. You know, you only get 3 goals in the four quarterfinals matches, and sorry, four goals in the four quarterfinals matches, and three of them were in one game at Old Trafford. This France and Holland game, I'll be honest, I don't remember a thing apart from Seedorf missing his penalty and Blanc scoring his. Was it inevitable given the previous performances?
I think so. I think it was. I think it was a little better. But I think that was also France were a little cautious. It's a knockout game, obviously. So they didn't want to throw too much at us when, you know, we did have a lot of attacking talent still. It was a better performance, obviously, you know, getting to penalties. But I mean, Seedorf and Cocu missed big chances late on. But you never really look back and think, oh, what if? Because there was a sense of, you know, we weren't going to do anything even if we got through that match.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great performance. But France weren't much better, and they also went out in the shootout. But, I mean, France, obviously, for them, this was like Zidane's first tournament, Jorquef's first tournament and stuff, and then they would come to fruition a couple of years later, of course, the next two tournaments. But from a Dutch perspective, how much did they learn from their previous mistakes? Because they had a very good World Cup reaching the semi-final. They had a very good Euros, arguably should have reached the final in 2000. So they must have done something right after this. You reached the quarterfinal, you can say we went out in a penalty shootout, but at the same point, they didn't perform well.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you compare this to 98, which is still Gus Hiddink, same manager, a lot of the same players, it was night and day. You know, I think Hiddink definitely learned a lot. I think he learned how to manage the younger players better. That was never really a strength of his. He always liked the more experienced heads. So I think he understood that, you know, Davids and Seedorf were this kind of new generation that did need to have their egos massaged a bit. And there's also kind of a natural development as well if you had these players getting older, getting into their primes. And of course, we had Frank de Boer back. He was injured for the Euros. Marc Overmars was injured for the Euros. Jaap Stam was... The development he went on between the Euros and the World Cup was massive. So it was definitely a combo. I think the squad was naturally better, but I think Hiddink as well took lessons from 96. And really, since then, he's been a manager he's kind of created a bit of a reputation for his man management over the years now.
Yeah, he certainly did well in eventually, but as I say, you're 96. Great. On to the current generation, you're 2024. So Netherlands obviously qualified from a group with France in second place, comfortably ahead of Greece and Ireland and Gibraltar. So in the it's a decent draw. I mean, there's always going to be this situation in the Euros where two sides meet each other again from qualifying and tournament. Of course, it's going to be France. You've got Austria as well, but we don't know yet who you're going to be facing. As we're recording, those playoff semi-finals are happening just now. So we'll know come the time this goes out. But regardless of whether it's Wales, Finland, Poland or Estonia, you're expecting Netherlands surely to come through in second place, at worst one of the best third place sides, surely.
Yeah, I think it has to be second place. You know, Austria are a good team. They've done really well under Ralf Rangnick, obviously, but no, I think with the squad we've got, the minimum expectation should be second place. We know France well now, obviously. We played them twice in the qualifiers. So I think there's no excuse to be brushed aside by them. You know, we know them. We should be able to give them a good game. And yeah, probably Wales or Poland, the other team in that group. Again, teams that we've played recently, actually. We played them in the Nations League before the World Cup. And yeah, teams we know well. I think we should be getting second for sure.
Yeah, and much further would you expect this Dutch team to go? I mean, they're ranked number six in the world. It's unfair to try and compare to previous sides, but you did get to the quarterfinals of the last World Cup, so surely that's got to be part of the aim, or does it just depend who you meet in the next round? I haven't looked at the draw properly to see who they can meet, etc.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think the squad's stronger than it was at the World Cup. I think we've got a pretty deep squad now. I mean, the central defenders, this podcast would be on for 3 hours if I listed all the great central defenders we've got. Midfield is great. We do lack that star striker that we've always tended to have over the years until Van Persie and Huntelaar retired. But we have a strong squad. The problem's been for the last year, we've had so many injuries that our starting 11 hasn't really been able to play together yet. So I think that kind of puts a ceiling on expectations. I had a quick look at the draw. I think we'd get a winnable last 16 match. Obviously, a giant could slip up and we end up with them. But I think if everything went as expected, we'd get Portugal in the quarters. And I don't think that's a match we'd win, to be honest. We're always terrible against Portugal. And they have a serious squad as well. So I think quarters, maybe more, if we can click, if all our players are fit. But that's a big if, with all the injuries that are happening at the moment.
I just hope that if you get Portugal, it's not a repeat of the last time you played Portugal in Germany. That's got its own Wikipedia page. You know, Battle of Nuremberg. Is it about World War II? No, it's about Portugal versus Netherlands, where four players get sent off. Incredible.
Yeah, 16 yellows and four reds.
Yeah, that's right. There was almost no players left in the pitch. But no, thanks very much for all this, Finlay. And as I've asked all my other guests to do, can you name a combined Euro 96 and current Dutch 11?
Yeah, sure. So goalkeeper is a pretty easy one, Edwin van der Sar.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, he wasn't even anywhere near his prime at this point. Obviously, he'd go on for another good, well over a decade. But yeah, I think he probably is the best Dutch goalkeeper of all time. That's an easy one. The back four, which I think is quite representative of the current state of Dutch football, I have actually gone for an all-current back four, just because Frank de Boer was injured at Euro 96. Jaap Stam hadn't really gotten started yet, so I've got Denzel Dumfries at right back. He's pretty close with Reiziger, but I think Dumfries edges it. Obviously, Van Dijk at centre-back, De Ligt, the other centre-back, and then Nathan Ake, left-back. I don't think that was... I considered Danny Blind over De Ligt, but I think in terms of pure talent, I think Matthijs De Ligt probably takes it. And then midfield, I went for Frankie de Jong. He is the last of the current generation in the team. Frankie de Jong and Edgar Davids is kind of like a two sitting in front of the defence. Then I've got Ronald de Boer on the right. Clarence Seedorf on the left, cheated a bit because he didn't play them much, but I had to fit him in. And then Bergkamp behind Kluivert.
Yeah, that's a pretty good team. And your back four has a good Scottish contingent because Van Dijk also played for Celtic and the boy Denzel Dumfries, Scottish team.
Named so, after the town.
town I was born in, ironically, as well. But yeah, he's not really Scottish, obviously. So, no, listen, Finlay, thank you very much. Good luck to the Netherlands in the tournament. And we'll see if you meet Scotland at some point. Wait and see.
Yeah, well, we are playing a time of recording. We're playing tomorrow. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, let's hope that you're not happy. But thanks very much.
No worries. Thanks.